Join us on the road to our 10,000th download and the launch of our new TV channel with the limited edition Mistaken Identity Podcast shirt made by Obvious Shirts, of course. Click the link in our show notes to purchase before they're all gone. Make sure to tag us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter while wearing your shirt for a chance to win additional merchandise. So, you think you can dance? Join the Community Sports Fans Dance Troupe and learn the baseball fan dance. Don't miss your chance to dance in the CSF official music video. All baseball fans are welcome. Please visit communitysportsfans.com for further details.
Club 400 Ballpark Lager is a beer for all nine innings. Take me out to the ball game. This crisp, easy drinking lager is perfect for a summer day amongst the bricks and ivy. Crafted at Crystal Lake Brewing, this beer is clean and refreshing with minimal bitterness so that you can celebrate a W in style. From Club 400, Cubs fans helping Cub fans, this baseball brew can be found at most places that sell beer in Northwest Illinois or from Crystal Lake Brewing. Beer master Ryan Clooney. Enjoy a beer or six pack today, and please remember to drink responsibly.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome back to the Mistaken Identity Podcast with David and Frank. I'm Joe Flaherty, and I'll be teeing up another special interview for you all from earlier this year during one of our virtual events. We had tour guide Kenny Metroff sitting in with Cy Young Award winner and Hall of Famer Fergie Jenkins for about an hour of great content. You'll be hearing that audio here. Fergie talks all about his roots in Canada, his experience with the Harlem Globetrotters, of all people, how he used to prepare for day game after day game, the glory days of 69, and so much more. Special shout out here goes to Raha Farhani for the production assist, and you'll hear her voice in this episode as well, asking some questions from the chat. So I hope you all enjoy this interview with Cubs legend Fergie Jenkins, and I'll catch you all later this week.
Luckily, our special guest is able to stay warm because you're not in Chicago, are you, Fergie?
No, I'm in a little town, Frisco, Texas.
Frisco? Oh, nice. And you just got back from a trip too, right?
Yeah, I was in Mexico, Puerto Vallarta, for a week.
Ooh, nice. And,
I got my other vehicle, had put a new battery in it, got it running, got the condo ready, and we'll probably be moving down there probably sometime in April.
Great. Is that an open invite for everyone?
Probably May. Excuse me, May.
Oh, in May. Okay. All right. Excellent. Well, I know we're all very jealous. That sounds like a fun trip. And then about how much of the year do you spend in and around Chicago typically in a normal year?
Well, when the Cubs call me back, I'm back maybe once or twice a month.
Oh, nice.
During the baseball season.
And when you're up here, aside from the ballpark, do you have a favorite neighborhood in town? Do you have favorite restaurants you like to hit up?
Well, Dean and Giorgetti's, I go there. Or, Ditka has a – excuse me, not Ditka. I think he has a restaurant. But I get back to Lowry's.
Yeah.
And just try to go to certain restaurants I really like, the Chop House.
Oh, nice. Nice. Fun. And I also want to say, too, thank you not only for doing this, but earlier in quarantine, for those that may not know, you, through your Cameo, set up a fund for Cubs employees, and you're one of the best on Cameo, too. And so I want to thank you because you did a wonderful video for my dad also. So.
All right. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. Because you're always great about taking time for the fans, because my dad, he came up for a tour, and at the end of it was a game day tour, and at the end he bumped into you at the gate, and you guys were talking like you were old fishing buddies.
that's good.
Yeah. And in fact, so much so that your security guard was like, come on, Fergie, wrap it up. Let's start at the beginning. You grew up in Ontario, and how did you find baseball? Because typically people don't think about baseball when they think of Canada.
Well, my dad played in they call the league in OBA, and I'm like 9 or 10 years old. My dad introduced me to baseball, and I enjoyed playing first base. I was a first baseman for I don't know how many years playing, as they call it, little league ball, peewee, bantam, juvenile. And at the age of 15, Gene DeJura, an area scout with the Phillies, moved to my hometown. And I'm playing a little ball. He watched me throw, and he wanted to know why I haven't tried to pitch. And I said, well, we have pitchers on our ball club. I'd rather play first base. Well, within a year, he convinced me at the age of 16, I started pitching. And 2.5, 3 years later, I signed a pro contract with the Phillies.
Wow.
Professional ball player.
Wow. And then did you ever dabble in hockey while you're in Canada? Yeah.
Well, I was a definite hockey player. My favorite team was the Montreal Canadiens. I started skating at 4 years old. And I was a pretty good hockey player. Played almost in junior hockey. And at the advice of Gene DeJura, he said, yeah, you're going to have to put one of these sports, either basketball or hockey, to the side and concentrate more on baseball, which I did. And I concentrated more on pitching. And as I said, in 1962, I signed a pro contract with the Phillies.
Yeah. And it worked out pretty well, right?
It did. I was really surprised. He knew more than I did. I didn't think it was going to work out that good, but it did.
Yeah. It'd be unfortunate if you're like, oh, I wish I stuck with hockey. Yeah. Well, we had very different backgrounds. I tried to be a pitcher once, and I actually pitched it over the backstop. I had terrible form, and that's when I knew not to play baseball anymore. So I guess we all find our signs, right?
Oh, yeah. Before long, everything like the water settles to a certain level. You find your level, and you stick with it.
Yeah, exactly. Now, so obviously you had that scout that advised you to become a pitcher. And then along your journey, especially early on, did you have a coach or a mentor that gave you some advice that like really stuck out to you?
Well, I had two coaches. In the Philly organization, when I went to winter ball, I had Cal McClish, which was a big Philly pitching coach in their organization. And then when I got traded to the Cubs, Robin Roberts was the pitching coach very briefly in 67 with the Cubs, so the player coach. The advice of pitchers that have learned and done it the right way and they become winning pitchers, I had an ear for what they had to say. And believe me, I tried to tune in on every basically topic that they were talking about, how to set the hitters up, what pitches to throw, stay with a certain pitch. And to that end, I think that I was very successful.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'd all agree with that. And so then growing up, who were your guys? Who were the baseball players that you looked up to?
Well, baseball was only played basically the Monday night or Monday afternoon baseball. That was a Mickey Mantle fan like everybody else. Willie Mays, Hank Aaron. In our area, the Detroit Tigers were real popular. So yeah. Jim Bunning was real popular, Norm Cash. I played against Willie Horton a little bit, Bill Freehand. But some of the names that when you look at players in the 60s, I had a chance to follow.
Oh, nice. Nice. And let's see. And I should mention, too, if people have questions, you can also throw those into the chat, too. And you mentioned Mickey Mantle. And you know, because I did a little bit of research leading up to this. One of your finest performances, you struck him out in the All-Star game. Am I correct?
I was very fortunate enough to have him call to basically take a call strike three in Anaheim in my first All-Star game.
Yeah. And so, because this audience here, we're all big Cub fans and obviously Cubs employees. What was it like for you when you found out that you were being traded to the Cubs? What was it like your first time at Wrigley suiting up for a game?
Well, I was quite surprised when the trade happened in 66. I was still with the Philly organization. I was at the big league ball club, and they traded me Adolfo Phillips, myself, and John Hernsey to the Cubs. And then I came over almost that same night. I drove the whole way from Philly to Chicago, stayed at the Edgewater Beach Hotel. The next day, I went and reported to the ball club. First individual I met was Yosh Kawano, and the second individual was Ernie Banks. And Banks, you know, he was like the individual that welcomed most players to the ball club. And I didn't get a chance to pitch until a couple of days later. And and I had a chance to talk to Leo, and he wanted to know in what capacity he thought I could help the ball club. And the Phillies were grooming me for a bullpen pitcher. And I said, well, I really felt comfortable coming in out of the bullpen. Maybe the third or fourth inning if it's a long relief, or late, maybe seventh or eighth inning. But that was the individual that gave me that opportunity to really pitch. Got a chance to pitch against the Dodgers. And in my first relief appearance with the Dodgers, I ended up beating them 2-0.
Yeah, take that, Dodgers. So you started out in the bullpen, but then you transitioned to starting pitcher, and correct me if I'm wrong, 267 complete games.
Yes, correct. Yes.
That's wow. Is there such a thing as a pitch count back then, or?
Well, I think the first couple of games after spring training, they kind of watch you. But
yeah.
I was very fortunate enough to really be in good shape. I threw a lot of innings in the spring, and my last start as a starter, I tried to go to complete game and pitch 9 innings, depending on how many pitches I threw. But yeah. Leo was the kind of individual that monitored a lot of the young guys, myself, Kenny Holzman, Bill Hands, Rich Nye, Joe Niekro. But I was very fortunate enough to never have an arm problem. And I was very fortunate to pitch a lot of complete ball games and a lot of starts. You know, 38, 40 starts a season. And I look back at that, I was very fortunate to stay healthy.
Yeah, that's great. And did you, looking back, were there any moments where you kind of butted heads with your coach on, like, they wanted to pull you, and you're like, no, I still got another inning, coach?
No, and Leo walked out there, and he had his hand out.
Yeah.
Give him the ball. You know, Joe Becker was another pitching coach I had there with the Cubs, along with Larry Jansen. And they just kind of reiterated, let's not argue. Let's comply with the circumstances. Either I was in trouble or it was time for the bullpen to be ready to come in. And I handed the ball to Leo, and that was it.
Yeah. Nice. And you said when you came over to the Cubs that Ernie was very welcoming. And did you find that when you were traded to teams, did you find that people are usually pretty welcoming, or were there a little bit of hazing to the new guys?
Well, no, my second trade, I got traded to the Texas Rangers, and Billy Martin was the manager at the time. So you didn't argue with Billy.
Yeah.
My third trade was to Boston. I got a chance to play alongside with Louis Tiant and Kari Yastrzemski and so many good players. I roomed with White Evans Dewey the 2 years I played in Boston. So, you know, the transition of getting traded is part of what the game's all about. So you can't do much about it.
Yeah.
Just go along with the program, find your slot, how you're going to do and help the ball club, and go out there and do your job.
And every time you got traded, did you have to drive across country? You had to drive yourself?
Well,
these players got it so easy now with private jets.
Well, two of the trades were during the winter months. I didn't have to drive.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Flew to spring training. Situation.
And it must have been so cool being able to play in, you know, call both of the most historic ballparks, Fenway and Wrigley, home for a couple seasons. And when we have people come on tours, everyone likes to make the comparisons and what the two have in common. Did you have anything that stuck out for you playing in both ballparks?
Well, I was very fortunate enough to pitch in some small ballparks. You know, Connie Mack Stadium was small, Wrigley Field, Fenway, and the old ballpark, Turnpike Stadium in Texas, had a win factor. But, you know, I think you tell yourself you can't do anything about the elements.
Yeah.
And you have to go out there and perform. And especially with Wrigley and Fenway, very small porches down the right field line. Especially they had the big wall there in left field. So, you know, you got to tell yourself, you're going to try to make the hitter hit the deepest part of the ballpark in that center field. It yeah. doesn't always work out that way, but you try to make the hitter hit the ball the other way and hit it to some of the deepest part of the fields. But I enjoy it. It makes you think. You had to concentrate them in both ballparks. Just don't let the situation get away from you. Try to stay in the pitcher's count, not the hitter's count, and to stay ahead of the hitter and make him hit the ball on the ground. Because you got two guys in the infield to do their job.
And with that said, when you played for the Cubs, did you prefer the colder months because the wind was usually blowing in? Or do you just hate the cold and you prefer the summer months even if the wind's blowing out?
Oh, it didn't really matter. I wore a long sleeve sweater most of the time. I enjoyed pitching in hot weather. You know, the humidity didn't bother me. I was in good enough shape, I think, to go out there and combat whatever the elements were. And I enjoyed the heat. I had a lot of heat in Texas and in Fenway Park in the summer months.
Yeah.
In Austin, it was warm. But I enjoyed just going out there and performing every fourth day as a starter, my turn to play. And I think that is very important, especially as a starting pitcher.
Yeah.
You know, if you sit on the bench and observe what the other guys are doing, and then when it's your turn to pitch, let's hope that the elements are good for you and the team scores a lot of runs.
Yeah, that's key. For sure. And were you pretty – did you have a pretty strong routine in between starts that you would try to stick to?
Well, yeah, I threw batting practice in between starts, which is an unheard of exercise now. Joe Becker was one of the first guys when he became the pitching coach of the Cubs was to throw batting practice that second day. And then lots of running. He had a motto. If you didn't run and run well, you couldn't pitch on his staff. Joe Becker was pretty tough. Dan Williams was the same in Boston. Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, you better run.
Yeah, that is very old school. Yeah.
Definitely, for sure.
We'll be a better track team than a baseball team. Let's go.
No joke. Yeah, that's it.
So I think I'll open it up now. I see there's some questions coming in on the chat. Here's a good one from Brian's iPhone. He says, "What do you have a memorable moment or moments from Wrigley Field?"
Well, you know, I had the opportunity to hit two home runs against Montreal one Sunday afternoon. The first home run I hit off a fellow teammate for a while. His name was Bill Stoneman. And now he works with the Angels. And the next shift player was Burton, hung a curveball, a left-hander. I hit two home runs that day. I think I had four or five RBIs.
Oh, wow.
Beating Montreal 6-1 or 6-2, which was, believe me, a lot of fun.
And so that leads me to this question, too. Since you were able to hit two home runs and take batting practice, and there's that element of the game for National League pitchers, what are your feelings on the DH for the entire league?
Well, I'm a firm believer. If you're an athlete and you can carry yourself well, I think you should be able to perform well going to the plate, being able to bunt or hit behind the runner. Or if the other pitcher makes a mistake, hit the ball. Try to hit as hard as you can and hit it through the infield. And those respectable things, I think, are part of what the National League is all about, being able to run the bases, hit, bunt, and pitch, and be able to field your position.
Yeah. No, I agree. And from a fan's perspective, there's nothing cooler than seeing the pitcher who's not supposed to be able to hit, get up there and swing for the fences. And, the guys I grew up watching, you know, Zambrano taking it out, Arrieta had some pop. And just watched a really cool clip on the Cubs YouTube about Travis Wood hitting a grand slam. Did you ever have a grand slam?
No. Most I hit is a two-run homer. But the big thing, as you said, not going to the plate and just thinking you're going to strike out.
Yeah.
I put the ball in play, and that's what I tried to do. I tried to put the ball in play, and a lot of times it got through the infield, or if you hit it hard enough, the outfield grass. And Wrigley Field was the kind of a a park that, and on the road, some of these smaller ballparks that I played in, Forest Field, Crosley Field. I hit a home run in Shea Stadium too. It's a big ballpark.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, just putting the bat on the ball, a good solid contact.
Yeah. Let's see. I got another question here. Oh, here we go. This is from Laura O'Shea. She says, knowing what you know now, is there any advice you could give yourself as a rookie starting out? What would you tell younger Fergie?
Wow. You know, I had a lot of success early. I just think that I had good control. Tried to stay ahead of the hitter. The number one thing that, and I was very fortunate enough to play against a lot of other top players like Gibson, Seaver, Carlton, Drysdale. I wasn't always the winning pitcher. Maybe I would have loved to have beaten them more. Being on the winner side of it instead of the loser side.
Yeah. And so when you're facing a well-known hitter like that, or you're in a big situation and it's crunch time, did you have any kind of mantra or anything you would say to settle yourself down?
Well, the biggest thing is when I look back, you know, Tony Perez probably hit more home runs off me than anybody in the big leagues. Maybe have a little more success when it was Cincinnati, Tony Perez, Willie McCovey. From time to time, you know, in the American League, Reggie got a share of hits. You know, I just think that the number one thing is that you try to keep the ball in the ballpark.
Yeah.
You know, that's the number one thing. Not give up a lot of those two or three run homers that are going to put your team further behind the eight ball and unfortunately not win the ball game. So that's a factor.
All right. Sounds good. Let's see here. We got – oh, this one's from Renee Hutchinson. It says, how was it playing with the Harlem Globetrotters? Tell well, us that about that.
I started playing with them in 1967, and I played three seasons in the offseason, October through January, with Metal Lark, Curly Neal, Jackie Jackson, Leon Hilliard. That was a lot of fun. They're entertainers.
Oh, and yeah.
When I joined their team, they welcomed me in because of the fact that I was a ball player. But I knew how to play the game, and I was in a few skits, and I was the pitcher every night during the third quarter that Meadowlark would hit a home run against me. So that situation is something that I experienced during the baseball season, and now I've got a famous individual, Meadowlark, hitting a home run against me in the basketball game. So that was fun.
And was there ever a Washington General that really scared you? Or
no. No. But you know what's really nice? I tell people, the 3 years I played, well over 180 ball games, we never lost.
Wow. Incredible.
Never lost to them. Yeah, really. Both daughters always won.
Yeah, good. And with that, because I know the Globetrotters had a game at Wrigley Field. Have you ever taken in any other events outside of baseball at Wrigley?
Ooh, I was I dropped the puck along with I think Ted Lindsay and Bobby Hall, a bunch of the guys when they had the hockey game in January in Wrigley. Yeah. But that was a lot of fun. Billy was there around Ryan Sandberg. We were all there at center ice dropping the puck. So that was a lot. Nice. That was a great experience. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And that was before the video board. So I was way high up. I actually didn't get to see, I was in the left field bleachers. That was a great first period of hockey. No one remembers who won that game though. So
I think the Blackhawks lost.
Yeah. Pretty bad. So have you converted to being a Hawks fan since you were a Chicago star, or did you?
Well, I followed them when they won a couple of Stanley Cups. I was always a Red Wing and Montreal Canadian fan. And when I played for Chicago, I became a fan of the Chicago Blackhawks. Boston, I was a Boston Bruins fan.
Very diplomatic.
Texas didn't have a hockey team. Texas didn't have a team at the time.
Yeah. Well, then they realized that and they brought the Stars down.
Yeah, definitely from Minnesota. You're right. Yeah.
Let's see. A lot of a lot of people enjoying the Globe. Oh, so Renee wanted to follow up. How'd you get recruited by the Globetrotters? Or did you seek out the Globetrotter gig?
Well, Joe Anzavino was the marketing individual with the Globetrotters. Their head offices were on Michigan Avenue in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
So in late September, after I'd won my 20 games, he was at the ballpark. He got a hold of me and wanted to know if I was going to go back to Canada, would I like to tour with the Globetrotters and be basically the pitcher each night to give up the home run to Meadowlark. And I said, well, that'd be great to do maybe 15, 20 games. It ended up being so successful, they extended it to 35 to 40. They did it the following year in 68 and also in 69. So those three off seasons, I stayed in pretty good shape, just running up and down the court, doing shoot arounds, playing with the Globetrotters. So that was a lot of fun. And the travel and the money. So
yeah. Well, yeah. That's
all
great.
All three things are great. Staying in shape, travel, and the money.
Now, this may be a silly question because I haven't seen these Globetrotter clips, but when you say you were pitching, were you pitching a baseball or were you pitching the basketball?
I was pitching the basketball.
Pitching a ball. Okay.
Meadowlark hit it with two hands together and he hit it up in the stands. And he'd run around the bases, really act a little crazy. And they got the ball back to him. And Curly would always get it and say, tonight, I got you tonight, Meadowlark. And Meadowlark would say, hey, there's Superman, and hook slide into the plate and be safe. So it was a funny skit each night.
Yeah, where were the refs, though, you know?
Well, they stand on the sidelines.
Yeah, that had to be the easiest gig.
Yeah, you're right.
Being the ref for the Globetrotters. Let's see, we got here's a question from Fred and Jackie. What did you miss in Canada when you lived in the U.S.? And then when you go back to Canada, is there anything you miss about the U.S.?
Well, the biggest thing is to get home. I think a lot of times you feel comfortable being in your home country. I was really happy when Montreal, Canada got in the league. And then when I was in the American League, they had Toronto to pitch in those ballparks and to have a lot of the Canadian fans recognize me as a Canadian.
Yeah.
And then coming back to the U.S. was always fun to pitch in Wrigley Field. Some of the ballparks that I really pitched in and that did really well was Shea Stadium, Chavez Ravine out in L.A., and Candlestick Park pitching against the Giants. So I was comfortable pitching in different ballparks, especially in the U.S.
Yeah. And then when you would pitch in Canada, was there like, did you run out and get some Tim Hortons? Did you like immediately have to get some poutine? Or
I'm not sure if I did that or not, but you know, just pitching in two of those states, Parc Jarry in Montreal and the old CNL stadium in Toronto. It was a football stadium basically where he had to play until they got to the Rogers Dome, but I didn't play in the Rogers Dome. Played in the CFL ballpark, which is all AstroTurf, which was terrible.
Ooh, yeah, that sounds rough.
Yeah.
And it sounds like the ball would be even faster. Like,
oh, it was. Once the ball got to the infield, the outfield, it was extra bases, totally.
Yeah.
And you had to try to cut that ball off to, you know, stop the runners from basically getting an in-the-park home run or maybe even a triple.
Yeah. Whereas Wrigley, the grass was like, what, 6 feet?
Oh, the grass was like 5-6 inches high.
Yeah.
They had to step ball hard to the infield and then to get the outfield. So you could stop the runners from getting that extra hit.
Yeah, I think the outfielders actually had to have like weed whackers, right? Just to find it.
Well, a lot of times they used to say, you can't see your feet.
Yeah.
The grass is so high. Not anymore, though.
And sometimes we hear fun, like from a tour guide's perspective, we'll hear fun stories from players about the ivy and maybe they'd find different things in the ivy. Did you ever go out there and explore? Because I think it was a couple of years ago, Rizzo actually found remnants of a baseball in the ivy that had been there since the 40s.
No, that wasn't the case. I remember the situation. Jose Cardenal was playing center field in probably 1976 or 77. The ball got lodged in the ivy. Instead of running to where the ball hit, he ran like 6-7 feet the other side of where the ball hit and hunting for the ball. And then the umpires did the same thing. They ran right there and they said they couldn't see it. So now it's just a ground rule double.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the ball was 5 or 6 feet the other way.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a similar thing with
it's a trick that a lot of outfielders, if you're smart enough, don't run to exactly where the ball's at.
Yeah.
A little further, a little further away and hunt for the ball. So
yeah.
Once you can't find it, automatic ground rule double.
Probably a little different in the age of replay now. They'd be able
for sure. Yeah, they didn't have that.
Well, I know a fun story we like to tell on tours is when Jim Edmonds was playing center field for us, ball went in the ivy and two balls popped out. Hmm. And he played both balls because what are you going to do?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah, but they ruled that a ground rule double also. Yeah. I don't know if you remember that game, but I think it was the 08 season. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Some more questions from the chat. From Terry Buck, I believe our dance contest winner. He said, what were your feelings when you found out you were being inducted into the Hall of Fame? Like when you found out and then the day of being inducted, what was that journey like?
Well, you know, I was on the Hall of Fame ballot in 88 first. With the Skremski and Bench, and that's what they took into the Hall of Fame. The next year, I think they took Palmer and Morgan in 90. And then in 91, I went in with Gaylord and Rod Carew. So Jack Lang phoned me the day before, which was a Saturday afternoon, and said that the three of us were leading candidates in points to get 75% of the vote. And then Sunday phoned me at 5 o'clock. The call didn't come at 5. It came at like 10 after 5. And I was standing by the phone waiting for it to ring. But when it didn't ring at 5 o'clock, I said, well, I guess I didn't make it again this year. And then it rang at 10 after 5. Pretty happy.
Yeah.
His words were, congratulations, Ferguson. You are now in the Hall of Fame. And he said, I'll get back with you in about 45 minutes to make plane arrangements. You got to come to New York for a press conference. And the first individual I phoned was my father. And I phoned my dad and got a hold of him, and he was pretty happy.
Oh, nice. Nice. Both when you're a player and then maybe now, what were some of your favorite ways to unwind when you weren't on the mound?
Well, you know, back in the room, I roomed with Ernie Banks the last 3 years he played with the Cubs. And just to be back in the room and listen to what he liked to talk about. He never talked about himself, always about how we can improve the ball club. But just relaxing, I think, was the number one thing, especially if you're on the road. When I roomed with Jim Bibby was kind of a gentle giant with the Texas Rangers, and he loved to eat ice cream. So he would always order room service, and it'd always be a banana split or something like that. And we'd enjoy doing that. I roomed with Dwight Evans. He always wanted to go to movies, and I wasn't a big movie buff on the road, but it'd be the odd time we'd go to movies. But, you know, that's something that you try to wind down before ball games and then go to the ballpark. And if you're pitching that day, you better concentrate on what teams you or the players you want to beat, and the team, especially if they're a hard hitting ball club, that type of thing.
Yeah. So what about in the off season? Obviously you get to Mexico now, but are there other activities?
Well, those three years I played with the Globe Cup, but other than that, to head back to Canada, my dad and I had a farm together in Blenheim, Ontario. I was raising quarter horses at the time and some cattle, and just to be home with the kids. I had in my first marriage, I had three teenage girls. So it was good to have dad home at the time, a little advice here and there. And just to be home in Canada was a lot of fun to be there at home.
Nice. Let's see. This one's from Larry. So knowing how you pitched when you were in your prime, how do you think you would stack against today's hitters?
Oh, I'd get them out. No problem. Yeah. No problem. Well, the new report now, the ball's not as lively. So a lot of times challenge the hitters. But when I look at my era, we had so many great hitters in the National League, from McCovey, Mays, Aaron, Stargell, so many good players, Dick Allen, that the hitters that hit that play now, I probably have some success against them. It really depends on who the hitters are. I had a pretty good slider, pretty good sinker. I had some success at making them hit the ball on the ground. You know, and when I look back, I had Kessinger at short, Beckert at second, Ronnie at third, Ernie at first. And I tried to keep the ball in the infield, and those guys had pretty good. A lot of these guys won gold gloves, so that's very important to have some guys that know how to field behind you.
Yeah, when you got a bunch of gold gloves behind you, the job is much easier.
Easier to play. Yeah, you're right. And that's the same thing in Boston, had pretty good infield. You know, so I look back, and also in Texas. So that really helped.
Who would you say then today, modern players, who would be the toughest out, in your opinion? Ooh. If you're willing to divulge.
Toughest out in baseball now. Well, you know, Albert Pujols was in the American League. He's a little older now, but he was a fine hitter with the Cardinals and now with the Angels. Probably Trout. He's going to probably give you fits from time to time. So those are some of the good hitters that in that American League.
And you said Pujols played for someone before the Angels?
Oh, he was with the Cardinals for years.
Oh. Well, I tried to block that out of my memory. I forget those years.
Really, really, really heavy back then. So, basically the American League with the Angels. So he was the kind of guy you had to consider, home run hitter, put the ball in play. So,
yeah. Well, that's great. And I got another question from the chat. Going along with what you were talking about, that the heat didn't bother you. But now knowing that the Cubs have a certain amount of night games, do you ever wish that you had that type of schedule where you had some night games at Wrigley, or did you like all day baseball?
Well, I enjoyed to have that opportunity to play day baseball. I'd get up in the morning, 8 o'clock, eat breakfast with the girls, and then head to the ballpark. And Billy and I used to join cars together, or George Altman. And we would travel together and we talked before we got to the ballpark and who I was going to face, teams, things like that. But I probably would have enjoyed pitching at night in Wrigley Field, but they'd have a lot of shadows. The lighting system is not that good in Wrigley Field. So there's a lot of shadows in the outfield. But, you know, it's a game of baseball. You got to play. Regardless, night or days, go out there and do your job. That's it.
Then the seagulls come in about 4 o'clock, right?
Yeah.
So you got to watch out for the seagulls.
In the grass, really.
Yeah. And going back to, because you mentioned one of your fond memories was hitting two home runs in a game. Did the pitching staff, did you guys ever place bets, or like if someone hit a home run, did you have to get them a steak dinner or anything like that? Any fun traditions like that?
We had a pretty good hitting staff. You know, Kenny Holstman's a pretty good hitter. Milt Pappas was a decent hitter. So there was always that number one challenge of who's going to get the most hits during the season. And quite a few of the years in Chicago, I think one year I had 22 hits. One other year I had like 15. So Kenny and I always had a bet about who's going to get the most hits during a championship season. So, but that was a good challenge.
Yeah. And did you put some big money on that, or is it just a friendly?
No, it'd be a steak dinner or a steak dinner. Champagne, that type.
Oh, all right. Nice. Oh, here we go. Do you have a favorite? This is from Tristan. Do you have a favorite memory from the Cubs convention and Cubs caravans?
Well, you know, Dallas Green was one of the first individuals to start the Cub caravan. So we'd go to different cities in and around the Chicago area, Peoria, or to head up towards Wisconsin, the Wisconsin border. There's always some cities up that way. You wanted to Kenosha to go.
Yeah.
A lot of good Cub fans. I think the Cub convention, because of the fact there were so many individuals that would be there, used to be the Chicago Hilton and Tower, and then they went to the Sheraton. You know, 5,000-6,000 fans. Most of them in the hotel lobby when you try to sneak in. But I mean, it's good to see that many Cubs fans that enjoy the month of January and it's sometimes super cold. It may be in their Cub gear with a shirt or whatever, a hat.
Yeah.
And being that they wanted an autograph. You try to satisfy a lot of the kids. A lot of times, a lot of grown-ups. You just can't get through the whole crowd. But you try to autograph as many as you could before you got to your room. That type of
thing. Yeah. And was there, at those conventions, was there ever a level of fandom that you're like, wow, okay, you are a legit fan, like someone that was maybe in full uniform, maybe some like really unique Cubs tattoos?
Oh yeah, there was always the odd individual that had a tattoo on their ankle, the Cubs C, or the bear on their arm. So they would always show you that, and they would be individual that were diehard fans would tell you right away. Or they show you there was a Cub card that had the diehard Cub card.
Yeah.
They'd show you that a lot of times. And I think that started in the 60s.
But, oh, gosh.
Individuals now, they put a tattoo on their arm or their leg or their ankle that they are Cub fans.
Yeah.
Well, it was nice to see. You know, if you're going to a tattoo parlor, believe me, you believe in the Cubs. Put it on the Cub insignia on your body for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And let's see here. I got a question from Deborah. Oh, was there a field or a stadium that was your least favorite to play at?
The Kansas City ballpark. It had AstroTurf. And I think it's still there with turf. You know, that park, to me, it was hard to warm up in the ball. Had a real small bullpen. And then they had the AstroTurf was in favor of the hitter. So, and they had some pretty good hitters back then. You know, Frank White, Willie Wilson, so many guys that could put the ball in play. And a lot of times extra base hits were part of their repertoire.
Yeah. Man. Yeah, I think back on some of those old ballparks and that AstroTurf. And, because I actually grew up near Peoria, Illinois. So we would go to Cardinals games and Cubs games. And that old Busch Stadium, like in August.
It was 120 degrees on that turf.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
I remember Sano and Kessinger, a bunch of the guys having buckets of water, would put their feet in between innings because they're on the turf. A lot of times, especially catchers and Becker and Williams in the outfield. But I was very fortunate. Stay on the hill. It's dirt.
Oh, yeah.
Not quite as hot, but it's still hot.
Still hot, yeah, for sure. And those jerseys, too. Were they still wool jerseys?
Flannel. We had the flannel.
Polyester?
Oh, yeah.
Flannel. Yeah.
Flannel. And they were warm. And they stick to you. But, you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah. These players got it too easy.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Uniforms are a lot easier now. Yeah. White with a stripe and blue, solid blue.
Yeah.
Or gray. Yeah.
All right. I see there's a hand up. I'll see if I can, I don't know if I can unmute. I see Kathy has a question.
Hi, Fergie. How are you? It's great
I'm
to
fine.
See you.
I'm fine. Doing great. Thank you.
Yeah. We had the pleasure the other night of meeting a couple of your children. And it was
okay.
Yeah, it was great. It was a great conversation.
Thank you.
A question is that out of all the teams that you've played for and with all the players you've played with, do you think you are the closest to the 69 Cubs?
Oh, definitely. You know, there's so many good players on that ball club from Billy and Ron Santo, and Ernie, and Becker, Kessinger, Hundley, Holtzman, Hands. You know, I look back at we've lost so many guys. We just lost Hickman, I think, 2 years ago. Al Spangler's still alive. You know, we lost Willie Smith. I think maybe there's only 10 or 11 individuals off that 69 roster that's still with us, which is really unfortunate.
It is.
We all get old and Mother Nature happens, you know.
But you guys keep in shape. You guys look great.
Well, a lot of times that's what helps. If you stay pretty good shape and if your health is one that you keep working hard at it, you're going to be around a long time.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for doing this today.
Thanks, Kathy. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So do you have a workout routine that you stick to now?
I work out from time to time, get on a stationary bike. I have a bike I try to ride from time to time. I don't lift a lot of weights.
Yeah.
My diet is not as it was when I was a youngster. Eat a lot of sweets. I don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
But
that's the tough part.
Yeah, the carbohydrates and sugar, you got to stay away from a lot of those. But you got to watch your waistline.
Yeah. And a question coming in. They were asking, you know, because you mentioned your hockey experience. Do you still try and get out and ice skate when you can, or have you hung up the skates?
I haven't skated in a couple of years. I haven't skated. Yeah. But I go home to Christmas, especially to Ontario. I try to skate with one of my grandkids, go to the arena and skate. I still have skates. I still know how to lace them up, and I know how to use them. Just haven't had a chance to get on the ice.
Yeah. And maybe you mentioned it, but did you have a position when you were playing hockey, or did you just kind of move around?
I was a defenseman.
Defenseman.
I played more defense than any other position as a youngster. And I enjoyed that part of it, being able to, you know, block shots or move the puck, get it to a forward and let them do their job. But other than that, defense was something I really enjoyed doing.
Nice. Let's see. I don't know if I see any other hands. And just so you know, there's a lot of people in the chat that are very appreciative of your time, and that you've been a big influence on them. And also too, in your journey as a ball player, were there any major obstacles that you look back on and that you are proud that you were able to overcome?
Wow. You know, I had some tough series against Pittsburgh, but pitching in Forbes Field or Wrigley Field was a challenge against the Pirates. I look back, trying to beat that organization was tough from time to time. Other than that, you know, I enjoyed life. Life was a lot of fun playing baseball. So
nice.
I saw somebody ask, I know you said the heat didn't bother you, but do you think all those games exhausted the team as a whole and prevented them from winning more because of all the day games, that there was less time to rest? If there was more night games, it would have been a lot easier maybe?
You know, that was brought up quite a few times, and the 69 team that played so well for 5 months, and then we were overtaken by the Mets late in the season. You know, we got hits. We didn't score as many runs as we did earlier in that 69 season, because we really scored an average 5-6 runs a game. And then we kind of cooled off to maybe scoring 1 or 2 runs. And I think this is the reason why the Mets came on, that they had a 5-man pitching staff compared to our 4. But other than that, when I look back, I don't think the heat really bothered individuals. You know, Ronnie was out there for 150 games plus, Kessinger, Becker, Hundley, Ernie, 100 games plus. So, you know, to really get a true answer, I put a lot of those chat things in the book that I wrote about the 69 Cubs. But I still believe that if we'd have scored more runs and played a little better in September, we'd have given the Mets a little more stronger finish.
And then Phil was asking, on days you were a starter at Wrigley, what was your game day routine, and when did you check the wind?
Well, a lot of times I did a lot of running, so you'd always check to see how the wind factor is. If that following day that you're going to pitch, if the wind is blowing in or out. But you can't do much about the elements, so I look back. You just got to go out there, and you got to play, and especially when you – I lived in the south side of town for quite a few years, and then I moved over to Irving Park, and as you – got close to the ballpark, you could look at the flags to tell you which way is the wind blowing in or out. So that was always a factor.
And Alan is asking, did it feel different on the mound when you pitched to the greats, Hank Aaron and Willie Mays, et cetera?
Well, you know, you give these individuals a lot of respect. Tony Perez, as I said, probably hit more home runs against me than anybody else. Dick Allen, McCovey, Mays, Clemente. Some of the good hitters you had to face, Johnny Bench, Pete Rose. The number one thing that you're trying to tell yourself, you got to stay within yourself and pitch to your strength, not to a weakness. And same with the hitter. They're going to try to pick out your weakness, especially if you hang a pitch, hang a slider, got a fastball up in the strike zone for them to put the ball in play. So you got to try to stay within your strength.
I had a question. When you won the Cy Young, I know like when I started working at Wrigley in 2016, I went in feeling like that year was different. Did you go into that year of pitching feeling like it was different, like it was your year?
Well, the 70 season, I had won, I think, 21 ball games. And then the following year, you try to be consistent. So I was very fortunate enough to – the ball club was really playing well behind me. I think I beat Gibson opening day. I pitched 10 innings. Billy Williams hit a home run. I think I beat the Cardinals 2-1. And then the following two or three days, I went to St. Louis. I beat him again. I was very fortunate enough to have a winning season. I think that year I went 24 games and outpointed Tom Seaver. So when I look back, it ended up being a good year for me.
Another question here from the chat. With the new changes in baseball last year, since it was such a unique year, they added the rule in extra innings that you start with a player on second base. For regular season games, what are your thoughts on that rule to kind of and these other advancements to try to speed up the game per se?
Well, speeding the game up is really something that is in order with the pitcher. He has to get the sign, pitch to the catcher, stay ahead, don't have a large or have the amount of pitches you throw in an inning into the 30 range or high 20s, least amount of pitches as possible. But I still think there's a disadvantage if you put a runner on second base with no outs. They hit behind the runner, now he's at third. You can win a game by bunting him in or hitting a sacrifice fly or a base hit. So a lot of times, I think it's to your disadvantage of having a runner at second base.
Yeah. So you don't like that?
No, I don't like the rule at all.
Yeah.
No, I'm not a fan of that rule and not a fan of the DH in the National League either. I think if you're a complete ball player, you should be able to carry yourself to come to the plate and not be just a week out.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm old school. I'm not a fan of catchers wearing helmets. None of that.
Yeah, you're right.
And then that's what we joke about too on tours. People have this nostalgia for Wrigley and complain about the lights and stuff. But if you go way back into Wrigley's history, there was a time when there was no outfield wall. There was just a rope.
Yeah.
And if it went under the rope, it was a ground rule double. If it went over, it was a home run. And the and us Cubs employees actually got to move that rope to our liking. Do you wish that was ever a factor when you played, or did you like a wall?
Well, yeah, the wall's a lot easier. You can tell how bad you're being hit. if the ball's off the wall, the ball's still in play. You know, there's a lot of parks that now that they have that yellow line around the upper part of the wall. So if it's over the yellow line, it's a home run. But if it's below, you play the ball. Especially when I was in Fenway Park, Carl Yastrzemski was the best left fielder to play out there. That ball off the wall, he could get it back in the infield as quick as possible, hold the runner to a single. Ted Williams was a great outfielder for that too.
Yeah.
Jimmy Rice got better as he played, but that's how you play the wall. We had Freddie Lynn in center field, but I think that having an individual that knows how to play that position can keep the runners from getting that extra base hit.
Nice. And let's see here. Other questions from the chat? Just a lot of people that are very thankful for your time, which is great, and I agree with that.
Okay.
Hey, everybody. Joe Flaherty here with the Mistaken Identity Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode. We want to thank you for your continued support. We also want to extend a heartfelt thank you to those of you who have written reviews, dropped some likes, and shared our shows, as that has allowed us to grow beyond any of our expectations. As a matter of fact, we're excited to announce a new way for our loyal listeners to enhance their experience even more with our new membership feature. All you have to do is jump in the show notes and follow the link to our Patreon page, where you can find access to a whole bunch of extra goodies for as little as $3 a month. You'll be given access to exclusive content, merchandise, behind-the-scenes video, early access to episodes, the ability to make special requests for guests, and much, much more. Now, if that sounds like something that interests you, head on over to Patreon and search Mistaken Identity Podcast, or simply follow the link in our show notes to join the likes of Nancy Sullivan, Alice Daniels, and Kathy Chester at the rookie level, all the way on up to the Hall of Fame level with longtime listeners Kathy Wheatley and Kathy Grossman. As always, we can't leave without our disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely our own, and we do not speak for or on behalf of the Chicago Cubs or any other organization. Stay safe, and we'll catch you next time.